Welcome to the Portland Christian Center podcast. This week, our special guest, Dr. Denny Davis, shared a message out of Matthew chapter 7, titled Portland's Unstoppable Building Boom. Now here's Dr. Denny.
One incredible experience for me to get back to Oregon and to get back. This is probably my second church in Oregon. You know, I was 20 years at People's Church in Salem, but I love this church. And I really want to thank Pastor Ray for the invitation to be here during his sabbatical. By my being here is going to make you more happy that he comes back. So I think that was by careful design that he did that. And the staff has been great. And a lot of these guys I've known for a long time. So it's been wonderful. I may move to Portland and start a union for church secretaries. Cheryl Landis emailed me once on Memorial Day. And then another time, she answered an email at 12:30 midnight. And I told her at that time, I think I'm going to come and start a union for church secretaries that work on Memorial Day and at midnight. I'm not sure you can afford her after I get through establishing the union. I feel excited about being in one of the great mission fields in the world, and that's Portland, Oregon. You've received the report. I received the report this year from a denominational one of our leaders, not here in another state, with a report from the Huffington Post that Portland now has been designated as the number one church in the nation, as the most unchurched city. Secondly, that report also said that 42% of the people in Portland never go to church. That's Christmas, Easter. They never go to church. They have no connection with the church. I think maybe some strategy meetings need to go on in this church, and how we're going to touch John Q. Pagan. And how we're going to reach that secular person and that secular mind. I feel that people want to go to church. I know that we have what they need. And I think we've got what they want. If we can just some way market it and package it in such a way that we can attract them. Most people don't come to church because of a website. A few do. I had a lady show up the other day, and it was so nice because she got into the website, and she said to me at the door, this is my first Sunday. I've watched you on the website, and my daughter was raped and murdered, and I felt like I needed to get to church. Not a lot of people come that way. Do you know how most people come to church? Because somebody invited them, and then they brought them to church. They didn't just invite them. When we were in Salem, Nancy and I were eating in one of our favorite places, and we ate there often, and we knew the proprietor. This young guy came by our table one night, and he said, I'd like to get our girls in Sunday school. They were about 8 and 10 years of age, never been to Sunday school in their lives. And Nancy said, oh, that would be wonderful. We'd love to have them. Then here's a guy that's meeting the public all day long and interacting with people. His next question to us was, what happens right after you walk in the front door? Here he was afraid to come to church because he didn't know what would happen. He didn't know what, maybe there was a buzzword you were supposed to say. He didn't know what he was supposed to do when he came through the door. I think there's a whole world of people out there just like him that are looking for something, and we've got it, so let's share it, right? Ron and Judy, Ron just got back from his 50th wedding, 50th high school reunion. And when Ron got there, most of his classmates got so old they didn't recognize him. But anyway, I heard the other day about a guy that went to his 60th reunion. So Ron, you've got this to look forward to. He was a widower. and she was a widow. And they had known each other for a number of years before and after as classmates. And they had attended reunions in the past without fail. So on their 60th reunion, they got together again. And they had a nice lunch at the reunion with another two other singles. And then they had a wonderful evening and their spirits were high. And the widower kept throwing admiring glances across the table, and the widow smiled coyly back at him. And finally, he picked up the courage, and he said, "Will you marry me?" And after about 8 seconds of careful thinking, she said, "Yes, I will." And the evening ended on such a happy note, but the next morning, when he woke up, he was troubled. He couldn't remember if she said yes or no. And try as he would, he racked his brain and he could not remember what her response was. But he remembered, you know, what a nice time they had. But with fear and trepidation, he picked up the phone and he called her. And first he said, "I want to explain what a wonderful evening we had together. I just loved it. And it took me a lot of courage to ask you if you would marry me. But for the life of me, I can't remember. Did you say yes or no?" "Well," she said, "you silly man. I said yes, and I meant it with all my heart." And the widow was so relieved, and she said, "I'm so glad you called because I couldn't remember who it was." So Ron, you've got a little bit to look forward to, and we hope you can keep it together for the next 10 years. With Judy, that would help. So that would be good. I want to leave a scripture this morning from Matthew chapter 7, verses 24 through 29. I'll talk about where that scripture appears in the Bible in just a moment, because it's at the end of the greatest sermon that was ever preached. And Jesus said this, and I'm reading from Moffat's translation. "Down came the rain, floods rose, winds blew, and beat upon that house, but it did not fall, for it was founded upon a rock." The New Living Translation says it was founded on the rock. "And though the rains come in torrents, and the flood waters rise, and the winds beat against that house, it won't collapse because it is built on a rock." There seems to be a building boom going on in Portland and the surrounding areas. I found, in a little bit of research, 153 pages the other day, my computer, of building permits that had been applied for and here in Portland. Now, some of these were for remodels and some additions. Sorry, I couldn't break it all down to tell you how many new homes were on those 153 pages of permit requests. But it appears that there is considerable building activity going on around here. For you guys that are involved in the business, I hope you know what you're doing. And for you who are recipients of their efforts, you better hope they know what they're doing. Jesus knew a lot about building. He grew up in the home of a carpenter, and he worked beside his earthly father, Joseph, for a long time. As you know, Jesus stayed at home until he was 29 years old. I've got my theory on why he stayed at home. Jesus, of course, being the firstborn of the Virgin Mary, she had other children, and I think Joseph must have died at a rather early age. And Jesus, with his great love for the family, stayed home to take care of those kids. I heard about another couple. I think they were in Portland Christian Center. They had been married 60 years, as this other couple went to their reunion at 60 years. This couple had been married 60 years, and they were having a little reception for them, a little luncheon to honor such a long-time marriage. And they asked the man, would you come and tell us the secret of your successful marriage? He said, well, on our 25th wedding anniversary, I took my wife on a trip to China. And on our 50th wedding anniversary, I went back and got her. That will help, I'm sure. But Jesus knew a lot about putting houses together, and he knew a lot about building. And I suppose that his illustration that he used couldn't have come with more knowledge than what he had about building houses. And I suppose this to me has been one of the most challenging stories and truths that Jesus ever shared. We must take careful note where it appeared in the Bible. Jesus had preached a long sermon. You can read that in these chapters in Matthew. It was a long sermon. He left incredible principles for living. He shared tremendous truths. And now, just when he comes to the end of the sermon, and just before he asked them to bow their heads for prayer, then he made that statement that everybody is building the house, and your house is going to be tested by a storm. We have a tendency, don't we? When we come and hear a message, we have the feeling that since we heard it, some way we have assimilated into our lives. Jesus said it is more than hearing truth. It is more than receiving principles, but is doing something about them. I think some of the most difficult people are people that have been in church for a long time. And they've heard the stories many times. And they hear it once again this morning. And I don't want to discourage you, because I need encouragement too. But people will come to the door and say, that was a wonderful sermon. Once in a while, I'll say, why don't you do something about it? Why? Because sermons are not just to hear. A message is not just to hear, but it's to assimilate into our lives and to act upon them. And that's what Jesus said. He who heareth these sayings of mine and what? Doeth them, then he's like a wise man who builds his house upon a rock. But he who hears these sayings of mine, my teaching, and doesn't do anything about them, he's like a foolish man who built his house upon the sand, and the storm came and the house fell down. A recent study was conducted on an Ivy League student who got an A in ethics and then went on to be arrested for rape. Now, how can someone get an A in ethics and become a rapist? In our Western worldview, there is no problem there, because getting an A in ethics in a Western university means that you know principles, and not that you believe in them or you apply them in any way, but you know them. One professor once at the end of an ethics course asked, how many of you understand ethics now? All of the students raised their hands in the affirmative. Then he asked, how many of you, as you leave the university, have the desire and intend to be ethical? And everyone laughed. In our world, we believe that if we can just know certain principles, maybe that's enough. And it's not. Jesus wants his students to be like him, to act like him, to walk like him, and talk like him. And he gave us a vision of what it would be like if we could live the rest of our lives like he lived. That's his desire for us. These people had sat on the mountainside and listened to his words with wonder and intensity. This undoubtedly, as I said, is the greatest sermon that was ever preached. Its principles are absolutely timeless. They are life-changing. And Jesus, of course, knew that. But he also recognized that we may know the truth, we may hear the truth, but the truth is something more than to be heard. It is something to be acted upon and made a part of our lives. They agreed with him because he had spoken the truth. He knew the tendency in human nature. He knew how easy it is to hear things and to agree with them, and then to go out and not do anything about them. No contractor gets a building built just by laying some plans out on the hood of his pickup. It's more than that. It's more than studying the plans. It's more than looking at the situation, but it's getting to work and putting the plans and all the details into action to make it work. Jesus told this story to drive home the necessity of action. It's not enough to know. It's not enough to agree. No word of his was given merely to know the truth. Every word is given that we might use it and that we might put it into action and that it becomes a part of the structure of our life. That's why in Moffat, when he said, "Now everyone who listens to these words of mine and acts upon them will be like a sensible man who built his house on a rock. And everyone who listens to these sayings, these words of mine, and does not act upon them, he doesn't do anything about them, will be like a stupid man who built his house upon the sand." This story is so simple, and it's got such a clear outline. Let me leave you three thoughts in closing. First of all, the first thing that Jesus is saying in this parable is that all of us are builders. Every one of us is building a house, and the house we are building is our own. Nobody's building your house for you. We are building our own house. And the house that we are building is important because we are the ones that are putting that house, not made with hands. We are putting that house together, and that house is becoming a part of our life and our existence and all that we have. So everyone is building his own house. The second thing that I want to share with you today is that the house that we are building is a house that we are going to have to live in. Let me just share a thought with you, and I think maybe the guys have it, on the house that we are building. Dr. George Buttrick said, "Every thought that we think and every hope and desire is like a piece of timber set in place, and every habit is like a beam holding it together. Every bit of imagination is like a window in the house. We may think that our deeds and our experiences are scattered and unrelated, but they are wonderfully cemented together as day by day the structure of the house that we're building is going together." Will Rogers said, "Even if you're on the right track, you can get run over if you just sit there." It's also true that while houses from the outside seem to look alike, they're not alike. Jesus said some are building wisely and some are building foolishly. I like what he said. He's not talking about good and bad. He wasn't talking about righteousness and unrighteousness. He wasn't talking about right and wrong. He was just talking about getting smart and doing what the right thing is to do. Think of it as something a lot of people feel that our spiritual life is something that's imposed on us from the outside. We live in a set of rules and regulations. I love that scripture that says, "Where the Spirit of the Lord is, there's liberty." Now, I've heard that quoted and taken totally out of context. There's been some wonderful and hilarious service, and somebody comes up to the podium and says, "Oh, where the Spirit of the Lord is, there's liberty." That has nothing to do with a worship service, but it's got everything to do with our hearts. The more of God's Spirit that we have controlling us and living within us, the freer people we are. It's wonderful to be set free. We're not bound by a set of rules and regulations. God set us free that we can be real people. My favorite verse in the Bible is John 10:10, the second part of the verse, where Jesus said, "I am come that you might have life and have it in all of his fullness and abundance. That's why Jesus came. He didn't come to establish a new religion. There was all kinds of religion in the world. He said, I'm come to give you life and give it to you in all of its abundance and all of its fullness. Sometimes we say to our kids and our young people when they ask, why should we be a Christian and why should we be what you call good? And we come back with an answer, you ought to be good because it's decent and it's respectable to be good. We ought to be good because you're going to be rewarded in the world to come if you're good. And our approach to some of these things is no deeper than the little nursery rhyme that said 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, all good children go to heaven. All good children don't go to heaven. And all bad children don't go to hell. We are saved by God's grace and nothing else. And when God comes, and listen, I believe in baptism. I believe in baby dedications. I believe in church membership. But your church membership card isn't going to get you into heaven any quicker than your Visa card. We've got to have a relationship with God. Did you hear about the man who died and went to heaven? And St. Peter met him at the gates. I feel sorry for Peter. He's never been in heaven yet. He's always at the gates. He's going to have a real shock someday if he ever gets in. He's been standing on those gates for eternity. So Peter says to the guy as he approaches the gates, here's how it works. We work on the point system here. You need 100 points to get into heaven. You tell me all the good things you've done, and I give you a certain number of points for each of them. And when you get to 100 points, then you can get in. The guy said, that sounds like a deal. So he said, first of all, I attended church every Sunday. Oh, Peter said, that's good. That's worth 2 points. 2 points, he said, well, I've given 10% of all of my earnings to church. Peter said, well, let's see. That's noble. I'll give you 2 more points for that. 2 points. He said, how about this? I started a soup kitchen in my city, and I work in a shelter for homeless veterans. Oh, Peter said, that's fantastic. That's worth 1 point. Well, the man said, I was married to the same woman for 50 years, and I never cheated on her, even in my heart. Peter said, oh, that's really great. I'll give you 3 points for that. 3 points, the man said. At this rate, the only way I'm going to get into heaven is by the grace of God. Peter said, come on in. You see, all this other stuff isn't going to add up to anything. It's only by God's grace and God's mercy and God's love. And we fill the whole thing with do's and don'ts that we often succeed in making the Christian life negative and unattractive. And like that sign I've seen, and you have too, everything good in life is either immoral, illegal, or fattening. There was a little boy eating his dessert, and he said, you know, this must not be very good for me because it sure tastes good. And that's the way we live. Anything that's good must be bad because it's so much fun and it's so good. This is the picture that many people have of knowing God, but they need to know this wonderful Christ who came to give us life in all of the fullness and excitement that he can give. Now, everybody is building their house, but everybody must live in the house that they build. There's an old story, and I really hesitate to tell it because it's so old, but I will. There was a guy that was the administrative assistant for a very successful businessman, and he had worked for him for many years and was so loyal. And the rich guy called him into his office one day, and handed him a set of blueprints. And he said, I bought a piece of property years ago out on the lakeside that overlooks the lake. I'm going on a world trip, and I can't tell you how much I've appreciated you and your integrity and honesty. Here's the plans for the house. And he gave him the plot plan where the lot was. And while I'm gone, I want you to build me that house. So the guy began his project when the man left. But he realized that he didn't have a retirement from this guy. And the rich man was getting old, and he wasn't going to be around forever. So while he was gone on this lengthy world trip, this guy called in unscrupulous subcontractors, put inferior materials in the building. But when they got near the end, then when the gingerbread all went on, it looked gorgeous. He no more than got finished, and the old man returned. He came into the office and he said, how'd the project go while I was gone? He said, sir, you won't believe it. Everything went like clockwork. He said, you're going to love what you see. He said, let's get in my limousine. We'll go out and take a look. So they drove out to the edge of the lake, and as they approached it, there it sat, this gorgeous, gorgeous house. They went into the house and looked around, and he said, Jim, I can't tell you how much I appreciate you. Your honesty and your faithfulness to me during these years have been unbelievable. And I've been wanting to do something for you. Because he said, you know, I'm not going to be around forever, and I'm going to retire before too long. And I wanted you to do this, but I want to give this house to you. And he reached out and handed the keys to him. Not too smart. When you're building a house that you're going to live in, that's not a very smart thing to do. And here was a guy that had cheated. He cut corners, but he ended up living in the house that he had erected. Now, last of all, every house will be tested by the storm. Some people say, well, I'm a Christian. And we sang some great faith-affirming songs today. I loved it. So we've been staying down on the coast, and all they're talking about is the giant tsunami. And I said to Nancy this morning, I wonder if we can hear the sirens if they go off tonight. And how can we get out of here? And then we sang about when the oceans rise. Oh, I got blessed this morning. I thought if I can just make it out of here in a day or two, I'll be okay. But every house is going to be tested by the storm. You see, some people have the idea, because I'm a Christian, no problems are ever going to come to me. There's only two kinds of people in this world, Christians and non-Christians. There are only two kinds of people that ever run into problems, Christians and non-Christians. We're all going to run into serious problems, and we're going to have our house shaken. Jesus said the storm, it wasn't the idea that the storm was going to miss them. The storm was going to come to everyone. But what's important at that time is how the house and what the house was built upon. I'm in my 60th year of ministry. And I've been with a lot of people. In fact, we had two deaths this week in our church at home. I've been with a lot of people that have gone through a lot of heartache and a lot of sorrow. I remember in our first church that we pastored in Pacific Grove, California, there was a godly woman in that church, and man. This woman, I have never met anybody like her. She had the glow of God on her face. I would have visitors come to that church and would visit with them later. And they'd say to me, who is the woman who shines? She had the shine of God upon her. And she wasn't some kind of a spiritual creep. I hate those kind of people. You know, I get very uncomfortable around them. Oh, I get very nervous when I get around these super spiritual creeps. But she wasn't that way. I was just a very young pastor, and if I had a really difficult case, I'd go pick her up and take her with me, because she was such a great woman. I love that woman. She and Fred had been married for 49 years. I hate to tell you about this relationship, especially for you men. Ada never learned to drive a car. She didn't have to, because Fred took her every place she wanted to go. Fred did all the grocery shopping. Fred carried her around on a satin pillow. I mean, it was disgusting. The way he treated her. I was hoping that Nancy would not pick up any ideas. But Fred became very ill, and was in the hospital, and I remember on a Wednesday afternoon, I was at the hospital, and Fred was laboring and gasping for breath, and I said to her, in my youthfulness and brashness, should we pray and just ask God to let Fred go home? Not a bad prayer to pray at times. And she looked at me so sweetly, and she said, oh, brother, do we dare? And I said, no, we don't have to. So we just prayed that God would take Fred and keep him in his hands and let his purpose be accomplished in Fred. And just when I was walking into the church that evening, into the office, the phone rang, and I got the word that Fred had just died. I knew what I had to do after church. I had to go by their home and see Ada, who was all alone. I wanted the service to last forever because I didn't want to go. I didn't know what to do. I'm just a rookie. And finally, I remember driving through the darkened streets. And I didn't turn the radio on in the car, I'll tell you that. I was praying like a madman and saying, God, give me something to say to that woman. I was pleading with the Spirit of God to come and give me some kind of a word for her. Finally, I got to the street where I had to turn the corner that her house was down that block. And I said, oh, I know God. I know how you work. You're going to give me something to say when I get there, because I didn't have anything to say. I pulled up in front of the house and I had nothing to say. So I got out, walked up on the porch. Still, I didn't know what I was doing, didn't have a word to say. I knocked on the door and I could hear the sound of her steps coming to the door, and I was panicking. And the door opened. I don't have anything to say. I'm just standing there. And here she is, with the glow of God on her face, a smile on her face, tears on her cheeks. And I stepped across the threshold, and she grabbed me. And she pulled me down. I can still feel. She got my head caught right down here. And she whispered in my ear and said, oh, brother, isn't God good? I didn't have to tell her anything. God had already been there because she built her house upon a rock. And the worst storm that she could possibly imagine had come. And here it had invaded her, swept over her, but the house was still standing. In Salem on a Wednesday night, I got home late. My Wednesdays were terrible in Salem. I met with some men early in the morning. Didn't go home for dinner. I would stay all through the day. And I got home about 10 o'clock that night and just got out of the shower. And I was just crawling into bed and my phone rang. One of the guys in the church said, tonight on after youth service, our daughter Shannon was on the way home and hit some black ice. And she's unconscious and is at the hospital. I said, Walt, my phone is right here by my bed. You know you can call me anytime you want. Nancy said, you're going down there, aren't you? I said, no, I'm too tired. She said, you're the pastor. I was so tired I couldn't get my clothes back on. And I got my clothes on and I went down. But when I got there, it wasn't as casual as the dad had sounded on the phone. Shannon was unconscious when they brought her to the hospital. Her temperature was already down to 80 degrees. And when that happens, that tells you you've got serious brain damage. The neurosurgeon came out about then and said, we've done everything we can, and we'll just have to wait because we don't know what's going to happen. So I stayed there with that family till 3 o'clock in the morning. And finally went home. I went back every day, went into the intensive care unit, and there was Shannon on life support. I would grab her hand, and I would pray with her and talk with her, though there was no response. I guess what really got me, she was a pretty girl, but and she was sitting with my boy. He knows how to pick them, too. She was sitting with my boy at youth service, and here are two kids sitting together, and now I'm dealing with Shannon. On Sunday morning, I invited the family to come and stand before the altar, and we prayed for Walt and Nettie that the Lord would bless them in some way, do a miracle. So every day I continued my journey to the hospital. I was out of my office in a meeting, and I got a call, and they said, they need you at the hospital. I dreaded to go because I knew what they needed me about. So when I got there before the doctor did, and the doctor came in the room and said, we think that it's time. We've done everything we can, and we probably need to disconnect Shannon from the machines. And the dad rather abruptly said, oh, you're going to pull the plug, huh? And the doctor said, no. And the way he stated it, we just need to let nature take its course. And the dad said, that's the right decision to make. So the doctor said, now, sometimes these people can live for hours and sometimes days even. And the dad said, we'll wait. And since he said, we'll wait, that meant, I'll wait. And the doctor wasn't gone for over 10 minutes. And he came back in the room and said, she's gone. I went over in the corner of the room, and I was crying. I wondered, what am I supposed to be? I'm supposed to be the tough guy. I'm the guy here to help people. I'm over in the corner of the room crying. And I heard the doctor say to the parents, are you going to be all right? And they said, oh, yes, doctor, we're fine. We put that girl in God's hands a long time ago, and that's exactly where she is now. We're Christians. And I wondered what I was supposed to be over in the corner crying. We had her funeral the day before Christmas. Christmas that year fell on Sunday. Her funeral was on Saturday, on Christmas Eve. There were scores and scores of young people there from church and her high school. And I didn't know how I was going to, I did okay. And the next day, Nancy and I were in a restaurant eating, and the doctor was there. And he came over to our table and said, how's the Large family doing? Oh, I said, doctor, they're doing great. I think what he was asking is, how are you doing? But you see, it wasn't my personal loss. It was their loss. And I saw a family who had built their lives upon the rock. And the worst storm that a family could ever imagine had occurred. And the winds came, and the floods rose, and the rains came down, and the house was still standing. And today, may I encourage you, if you haven't built your life house on the rock, get there today. Because every house is going to be tested. Every house is going to one day be tested by the storm. If you have your house on the rock, thank God that it's there, because you're going to be tested. And on that day when the storm comes, and when the winds blow and the floods rise, you're going to still be standing. And today we have the wonderful opportunity to make the decision. I'm going to put my house on the rock. And as I said last Sunday, yesterday is not that important, but today is the most important moment of our lives, because we make the decision today that we're going to put our life on the rock, Christ Jesus, and nothing's ever going to come that's going to take us off of that rock. We're going to have challenges, and we're going to have problems, and we're going to have disappointments, and we're going to have heartaches, but when our life is founded on the rock, we're going to stand.
Thanks again for listening to this week's edition of the Portland Christian Center podcast. If you want more information about the ministries of Portland Christian Center or have a prayer need, please visit us online at pcctoday.com. Thanks for listening.